Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast, your source for current events and issues within the legal practice. Today, the Federalist Society's Environmental and Property Rights Practice Group is hosting a discussion of the recent Supreme Court decision on Stop the Beach Renourishment Incorporated versus Florida Department of Environmental Protection. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on a particular legal or public policy issue. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. Today we have with us two distinguished attorneys who are deeply involved in the Stop the Beach Renourishment case. First of all, we have Kent Seyfried. He is a shareholder with the law firm of Hopping Green and Sams, located in Tallahassee, Florida. His practice focuses on private property rights, land use, growth management, and general litigation. He recently argued the takings claim on behalf of property owners before the United States Supreme Court in Stop the Beach Renourishment. He graduated from University of South Carolina School of Law in 1999 and before that received a bachelor's degree in aquaculture. We have also with us today Thomas W. Merrill. Tom Merrill is the Charles Evans Hughes Professor of Law at Columbia University. He was a law clerk for the Honorable Harry A. Blackmun of the Supreme Court in the 1970s, and from 1987 to 1990 served as Deputy Solicitor General in the Department of Justice, where he represented the United States before the U.S. Supreme Court. His teaching and research interests include administrative law, property, and environmental law. Publications, he has numerous publications, including The Landscape of Constitutional Property in Virginia Law, Law Review in 2000. What we are going to talk about today is the Stop the Beach Renourishment case. In this case, Florida beachfront homeowners tried to stop a beach renourishment plan, and they sued as that plan was going into place. The homeowners claimed that their beaches are not eroding. They did not need or want the state adding additional sand in front of their property. Now, let me set the stage here a little bit. Many homeowners in Florida are concerned about their beaches eroding, especially after major storm events and hurricanes. Those landowners are often anxious to see new sand put on their beaches to protect their homes and property. But the homeowners in Stop the Beach Renourishment were a little different. They were concerned that the sand was going to have adverse consequences. What consequences could those be, you ask? They were concerned that whereas previously they had primarily private beach, they would now have a vast new public beach in front of them. These homeowners said that their lands were naturally accreting, and after a storm, the sand would come back. But by placing 75 feet of new sand in front of their property, that meant that the public would have new beachfront that they did not previously had before. The boundary line between private land of littoral or oceanfront owners in Florida and the public is the mean high tide line traditionally. The state of Florida changed that. They changed that to an artificial line called the erosion control line, where in all new sand added on the water side of that erosion control line would now become public property, where previously under common law, sand that accretes slowly, imperceptibly, and naturally on the ocean side of the mean high tide line would become the property of the private owner. So the public had a very small stretch of beach here between the mean high water line and the water that they could walk on and beach and on and recreate on. But other than that, the public had limited access and limited ability to use the property here. Much of it was private property. With the new sand, there is new public beach, and the landowners were concerned about the noise, the lack of privacy, and other things that go along with a new public beach. So that's why they had fought this beach very, very hard. They eventually made their way up to the Florida Supreme Court. They had argued that what they once had was beachfront property is now beach view property, and they argued that this is a taking of their right of their property to touch the water. A sharply divided Florida Supreme Court ruled that the homeowners, however, never had a property right to have their land directly touch the water. The landowners lost that. There was a very strong dissent that said that there is a sudden and drastic change in Florida property law with the Florida Supreme Court's ruling, and the Florida homeowners took that to mean that there was a potential judicial taking, meaning that the Florida Supreme Court took their property by redefining it, by defining away their rights to touch the water, and by saying that this new public beach was, instead of private property, was now a public beach. They took the case to the Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court accepted review. And arguments were held last December, and now I'm going to turn the discussion over to first to Kent Seyfried, who will explain what the petitioner's arguments were here. Tom Merrill, on the other hand, will explain how the government responded to those arguments and what the government thought the proper rule should be. And then we're going to get into discussion of what the U.S. Supreme Court actually held. So first, Kent Seyfried, take it away and tell us what the petitioner's arguments were.
Great. Thank you, Jim. The petitioners presented basically three arguments to the United States Supreme Court for review as a result of the Florida Supreme Court opinion. The first is that the Florida Supreme Court opinion in and of itself changed Florida property law so as to redefine and take away property rights that the petitioners once possessed and hand those over basically to the state. That argument is known in the legal community as a judicial taking, or at least the doctrine of a judicial taking. So the first argument that was presented was, what is there such a doctrine as judicial takings? And then if so, did the Florida Supreme Court violate the doctrine? The second argument that the petitioners made is similar to the first one, but focuses more on a due process analysis, and that is whether or not the Florida Supreme Court's approval of a statutory scheme that replaced common law vested littoral rights with replacement statutory rights was a taking or violated the due process clause. And then the third issue that the petitioners argued was whether or not the Florida's Supreme Court's approval of a statutory scheme, again here the Beach and Shore Preservation Act, that unilaterally allowed a government agency to change a private property boundary without going to a judicial forum, violates procedural due process. Now, the major issue that the United States Supreme Court obviously focused on was the judicial takings doctrine, and it requires an in-depth analysis, if you will, of Florida property law. Two of the Florida property law issues that were argued that had been taken or deprived from the petitioners was the right to accretion and the right to maintain contact or the border of their property along the water, which is known typically in Florida as the mean high water line. And those were the two issues that were mainly focused on at the Florida Supreme Court level. So those were the arguments that were made at the United States Supreme Court level.
Thank you, Kent. And Tom Merrill, how did the government respond? And I should mention, too, because Tom Merrill had represented the county of Walton Beach in this case before the U.S. Supreme Court.
Right. Thanks, Jim. The case as presented to us was complicated because the judicial takings issue, the federal constitutional issue, had not really been litigated as a federal issue in the Florida courts and came up on petition for certiorari, so there wasn't any briefing of the federal constitutional questions below. We basically tried to make four points in our responsive briefs. The first was really kind of a framing thing, is to try to identify exactly what federal constitutional issues were before the court and which ones were not before the court. And we argued basically that the first of the three issues that Kent outlined was properly before the court, the question of whether Florida had changed Florida property law in such a dramatic fashion as to cause a federal takings violation, but that the other two issues that he mentioned were really recycled constitutional claims challenging the Florida statute, the Beach Renourishment Act, not the Florida Supreme Court decision, and that those were issues that could have been posed as federal questions below but were not, and therefore were not properly before the Supreme Court. Secondly, we addressed exactly what the standard would be for deciding when a state court construction of property law has raised a federal constitutional question. There's One can imagine a fairly clear case where the state court just simply announces that it's changing state law, and then you'd have no ambiguity about this. But the more typical case, including this particular case, is one where the majority of the Florida Supreme Court denied that it was changing state law, and so you have a difficult question of what standard of review a federal court like the Supreme Court is going to apply when it's addressing a state court decision about state law, where the state court says it's just clarifying ambiguities in state law rather than changing state law. So we addressed that question. The third question was whether, in fact, there had been a significant change in Florida law, or whether the Florida Supreme Court decision was a fair extrapolation of previous Florida law, and we argued there that there hadn't been any revisionism of Florida law of any consequence. There had been some clarification of things that were previously unclear, but nothing had that had been settled as a matter of state law had been dramatically upset. And then lastly, we argued that even if you could establish the predicate that there was a change in state property law, that wouldn't automatically give rise to takings liability. You'd have to show that the effect of that under established takings clause doctrine would be such as to create a constitutional violation. So those were the four main issues that we briefed in our response.
Thanks, Tom. We're now going to discuss exactly what the Supreme Court held and perhaps what it didn't hold as well. I should mention at the outset, if I forgot to introduce myself previously, I'm James Burling. I'm the Director of Litigation at Pacific Legal Foundation. And we did, and for full disclosure, file an amicus curiae brief in support of the property owners in this case, but I'm trying to be as neutral as I can in discussing this case. The eight members of the Supreme Court issued the opinion. I'll just mention briefly that Justice Stevens was not part of this proceeding, presumably because he owned beachfront property in Florida that had benefited from a different and other renourishment plan. Of course, the justices never say why they recused themselves, but we did have eight members of the court who were on the decision. So let's begin with Kent Seyfritz, who argued the case for the property owners. And Kent, what do you take away from the Supreme Court's decision? What does it mean to property owners?
Thank you, Jim. Well, I take away quite a bit from the opinion because obviously there were a lot of things said in the opinion and a lot of split opinions and concurrences that indicate numerous and multiple things for future litigants as well as future judges that face these cases. First of all, I think what we take away is the court was really interested only in the judicial takings case. That's became apparent to me from the opinion is what they wanted to address, and that's what they in fact addressed. And they kind of sidestepped, if you will, the other two issues or questions presented that the petitioners had offered on the third issue with the procedural due process claim, kind of saying that the petitioners didn't really argue that below and it wasn't really preserved. But then with respect to the substantive due process claim that we had in there, they addressed it in a footnote kind of at the end, saying basically it's the same as the judicial takings doctrine. We had not proved an established property right. So anyhow, the focus was on the judicial takings doctrine, as we suspected it would be when we filed our petition for writ of cert. We recognized that that was the argument that would get cert granted if there was one. So with respect to that issue, what did the court do? Well, they seemed to split in a very divisive fashion with the four typically referred to as conservative justices, Scalia, Chief Justice Roberts, Alito, and Thomas, in a plurality, indicating that there is such a thing as a judicial taking and setting forth a standard for that. While concurring in the judgment of the opinion, Justice Kennedy as well as Sotomayor opined that there's no reason to address a judicial takings issue or determine if such a doctrine exists because analysis in this case would fall under a substantive or procedural due process analysis. And even under that analysis, the litigants or the petitioners in this case didn't meet the standard they would need to meet to show that they have been denied due process. So from a standpoint of viewing the two major issues, is the judicial takings doctrine available? And two, did the Florida Supreme Court violate it? I think from a private property standpoint, the first point, which I could classify kind of as the war, it advances private property rights because at least there are six justices out there that recognize private property owners have some kind of remedy with respect to a court that redefines or alters established property rights. And then with respect to the second prong, did the Florida Supreme Court in this case violate that judicial taking right or due process right? And in that case, the court conclusively found all eight members of the court said no. The Florida Supreme Court did not do that in this case. Of course, you know, we disagree with that, but that was in fact the ruling of the court. The other issue that seemed to be invited at least by the plurality written by Justice Scalia was that these cases could be litigated or brought by parties or persons that were not parties to the state court judgment that presumably resulted in the taking or changing of the established property rights. And I think that takes us back to Scalia's opinion or rather dissent to denial of cert in the Stevens versus City of Cannon Beach case, where he was worried about state courts that establish or adopt a doctrine such as the doctrine of customary use that says all of the beaches of Oregon are now open to the public. He was concerned about a landowner in Oregon not being able to have their day in court and litigate that issue. So with respect to doctrines like this custom of usage and some other state court-created doctrines that may limit property rights, I think the door is still open and maybe even open further as a result of this opinion to those individual property owners to bring a claim in federal court. And I'll just stop there, Jim, because I think that's pretty much the main issues that the private property owners can take out of the ruling.
Okay, thanks, Kent. Now we'll go to Tom Merrill, who argued the case for Walton County and City of Destin. And Tom, what do you take away from the decision, and what does it mean to governmental entities?
Well, I agree with most everything Kent said. I would emphasize that the respondents won 8-0. In this case, the judgment below was affirmed. I would say that I think there is some significance to this case in terms of the riparian property rights issue, even though technically speaking the court's judgment here is just that the Florida Supreme Court did not depart from Florida common law in a undue fashion. I think still anytime the U.S. Supreme Court renders an opinion about property rights, certainly when it renders a unanimous opinion about property rights, that other courts and legislatures will take note of that. I was quite fascinated by the fact that Justice Scalia's rationale for why the Florida Supreme Court had not deviated from prior law, which was, again, unanimously joined by all members of the court that were participating, basically stressed that the Florida court's upholding of the state statute was consistent with prior Florida common law. The Florida Supreme Court had upheld the had upheld the act as applied or as on its face in this particular project by engaging in a kind of balancing exercise of public versus private interests. But Justice Scalia said, look, this is consistent with what Florida could have done under the common law. They could have, he said that under Florida common law, it was at least arguable that the state, as the owner of the submerged land below the mean high water line, could have engaged in a construction project to build a new beach, that if they had built such a beach based on their property rights, that would have injected a new strip of dry sand between the upland owners and the water, and that this would have been regarded as an avulsion, not an accretion, in other words, a sudden and perceptible rather than a gradual and imperceptible change, and that such a project would have necessarily meant there's no further accretion to the upland property and that there's no longer any contact with the water because this new strip of dry sand would have been interjected between the upland and the water. And so he said that this was an odd result or a counterintuitive result, but nevertheless it was authorized by the common law. So I think that aspect of the decision, although not of general jurisprudential significance, may encourage other states or to engage in these types of aggressive beach creation projects on state submerged land, confident that the U.S. Supreme Court has said this is consistent with the common law and that no takings issues are presented. So that's one possible tangible outcome. On what Kent describes as the war, I agree with him. I think that this was a victory of sorts for the property rights movement. It has put the judicial takings question on the agenda of the courts in a way that it really hasn't been up to this point. A 4-4 split by the U.S. Supreme Court on this question is undoubtedly going to attract a lot of attention and encourage further litigation of these particular questions. It's interesting that Justice Scalia, I think what happened in this case, there are like four parts of the opinion. Parts 1 and 4 were unanimous, and 2 and 3, Justice Scalia got only 4 votes. I think it's a sort of classic case of Justice Scalia pushing the envelope too hard. He, for example, did not apply the sort of the traditional fair and substantial basis test for asking whether or not a state court has manipulated state law to defeat a federal right. He tried to develop a brand new test for when state court decisions might raise constitutional claims, and he said it was whether or not the question was whether or not the state court had disregarded or eliminated an established property right. And I think by sort of venturing out a little too aggressively on his own, beyond the briefing of the parties and so forth, that Justice Scalia made Justice Kennedy sufficiently nervous that he lost an opportunity to get 5 votes. So as to the future, it's very hard to say. I mean, you now have the Kennedy theory that due process is the right vehicle competing against the judicial takings theory. I think there are some arguments as to why due process might work better than the takings clause does when you're challenging judicial decision making. Breyer and Ginsburg were basically not saying much of anything one way or the other. And it's going to be left up to the new justice, presumably Elena Kagan, to decide what happens with respect to these theories in the future. But I do think that this is now on the agenda, and there will be further litigation over this issue in the future.
Thanks, Tom. Kent Seyfried, do you have any response to Tom's discussion of the Supreme Court opinion?
Just a few, and I, like Tom, agree with most of what Tom said. From a state property perspective and these beach restoration projects in Florida, I think the attention is going to turn to as-applied takings challenges relating to these projects. This case was litigated based on an assumption that the erosion control line that the state set in the case was properly located on top of the properly located mean high water line. That's the basis upon which the case was litigated. There is an issue. There's still not an issue in this case and other cases in these beach restorations in Florida as to whether the ECL was properly located on top of the existing mean high water line at the time it was established. And I think both the U.S. Supreme Court and the Florida Supreme Court left open the decision to say if that ECL line was set landward of the true mean high water line, you know, there's an actual physical taking of some square footage of land. And just the other response to one of Tom's comments, I'm not so sure that this opinion will allow other states to aggressively adopt these beach restoration programs and do it the way Florida's doing it. I think under Scalia's test with respect to the established right, if other states' property law already establishes rights that would prevent a state from instituting a restoration project similar to what Florida did, then they're going to run into the judicial takings problem. if their common law is already consistent with Florida's, then yes, I think this case will be helpful to them. So it's really goes down to determination of what is the background law or the established property rights as it relates to accretion, erosion, avulsion, and all of those highly technical property rights in the various states to determine whether this case on its facts will actually help or hurt a state in furtherance of any of these beach restoration projects.
Thanks, Ken. Tom Merrill, do you have any comments or response to Ken's thoughts?
Well, only to point out that Justice Scalia not only cited Florida cases on the point that the this project could be regarded as an artificial avulsion, but he also cited treatises on water rights more generally, and I think was sort of speaking as if he understood that this was not just the Florida law, but the common law more generally. Kent's absolutely right that if you have other states that don't accept the characterization of such projects as artificial avulsions, then it would be a different ballgame. But to the extent that there's ambiguities about this in other states, the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court has not only construed Florida law this way, but has said that it was a permissible construction and has implied at least that it was consistent with the common law, I think that may encourage other states to follow suit.
All right. Thank you, Tom. Let me begin by asking a few questions. I want to stay on this point of avulsion for a second. And just for those listeners who might not be completely aware of the nuance here, when sand is put on a new beach or a new river area slowly and imperceptibly, that is, you can't see it from day to day happening, and it happens naturally, that new sand is generally considered to be under the ownership of the upland owner. And so the upland owner may gain property. Conversely, if there is slow erosion and the sand is removed from the beach or riverfront property for a riparian owner slowly and imperceptibly, the upland owner loses, and there's really nothing that can be done. But on the other hand, the common law has a separate idea for avulsion, that is sudden events where sand is suddenly deposited on property, say in a hurricane or some other means, and that sand is not considered to be have changed the property boundary. And the same way for erosion. If erosion is very sudden in a major storm event, the property boundary does not happen. And there was some discussion at the Supreme Court argument that if there was avulsion, then avulsion removing beach, then a landowner might have the right to put sand back. And so my question is, if we're going under the doctrine of avulsion, would avulsion allow a landowner to restore the status quo ante? Kent and Tom, do you have any comments on that?
Well, this is Kent, and my thoughts on that, you're right. At the oral argument, there was a lot of discussion regarding the doctrine of avulsion, and probably even more so the doctrine of reclamation, at least as it's known in Florida, which provides that if a landowner loses property as a result of an avulsive event, such as a hurricane, they are able to go in and restore that property that they lost so as to maintain contact with the mean high water line. And that was one of our arguments all along, is that not only does the doctrine of avulsion allow for a disconnect between the landowner's property and the water line during the common law, but the common law also has this mechanism to restore that. And interestingly, Scalia did not even mention the doctrine of reclamation in his opinion anywhere when he talked about avulsion, but the Florida Supreme Court specifically did. But with respect to the common law in Florida, yes, I believe the doctrine of reclamation still exists such that that landowner can go in and place that sand on their own. Now, whether the Department of Environmental Protection would ever permit such a one property private restoration, is another, regulatory issue that is, I think, unresolved.
Right. Tom, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things here is that there actually are, the avulsion was relevant to this case in arguably two different senses. There was the avulsive event of these hurricanes, Opal and Hugo, that came in and damaged the beaches cutting them back from where they had been previously. And under the common law, an evulsive event like that would allow the upland owner to restore their land back to the mean high water line. I guess Florida calls that a reclamation. But then the thing that Justice Scalia went off on, which was raised in our brief but was not talked about by the Florida Supreme Court at all, is that the construction of a new beach on state sovereign land can be characterized as an artificial avulsion. So there was avulsion one was the storm, and then avulsion two is the artificial project to create this new beach. So the Scalia opinion really talks about the second type of avulsion, not the first, and Kent's right, there really isn't any discussion of that in the U.S. Supreme Court opinion. My understanding of the common law is that typically, you know, a landowner that was upland of the mean high water line, where there's been an avulsion, would be allowed to engage in a reclamation back to the mean high water line. And another question would be if there's like additional sand deposited on their beach by the storm, in other words, they've got more sand than they had before, could they scrape that back and push it into the water? I don't know the answer to that, but it logically would seem that they could do that under the common law too.
Right, under the common law, but I would suspect the state of Florida might have a problem with that if the landowners went out with bulldozers and scraped off the newly restored beach.
Yeah, I don't know whether you need a permit. You probably need a permit to push the sand into the state sovereign area, if that's where the sand had come from, because that would be, you know, trespassing on the state sovereign land. The way these projects were done in practice, and this was not in the record, but I was told this by my clients, is that they tried to get at least construction easements from the upland owners to permit construction activity both upland and below the erosion control line in order to rebuild these beaches. So presumably, in most cases, there would be some kind of cooperative effort between the property owners and the state in response to these events.
That is true. The way these projects are constructed, and again, you're right, it's not in the record, Tom, is that once the regulatory permit by the department is issued for construction, the local governments or the applicant is required to go and get written permission from the landowners to enter their private property landward of the erosion control line, and the state has already given permission to enter the property seaward of that for the project. But in this case, my clients at least, and I know probably 30-40% of the other landowners within this project refused to give those construction easements, and that was one of the disturbing items of this case. But of course, it wasn't litigated because it happened after, you know, the hearing in this case, is that the local governments in this case decided to trespass on those properties and complete the project without that written permission over objections of several landowners.
Perhaps another issue for another day. Let me turn to the opinion itself and the test for judicial takings that the plurality of four justices set out. And Tom mentioned that there's something like whether a court eliminates an established property right. And frankly, in looking at the opinion, I thought Scalia didn't provide a whole lot of guidance as to what that means and how that's determined. And of course, we have the two justices, Kennedy and Sotomayor, saying that they think this might be a due process test. And so my question to both of you is, what kind of test do we have? Are we going to end up, say a litigant gets back to the Supreme Court in one of these cases, should that litigant be arguing the Scalia test? Should we be arguing the due process test of Kennedy, or a combination of the two of them in order to get the requisite five votes? Just as an aside, as you recall, in a case called Eastern Enterprises, a taking case before the Supreme Court several years ago, you had a plurality of four saying it was a taking, Justice Kennedy saying there was a due process violation, four justices saying it was neither a due process or a takings, but five said that there was a constitutional violation of some sort, therefore the property owner won. Is that what a landowner should be arguing for, and should the government then be focusing its arguments on both takings and due process? Tom and Kent, how do you advise clients to deal with that?
Well, Well, this is Tom. I think it's totally mysterious. This is not a situation where, like Eastern Enterprises, where you had, a majority of the court identifying a constitutional violation. There were two different theories in support of that. The traditional rule there is that you try to identify the narrower grounds for a constitutional ruling, and that becomes the preferred ground that you litigate until the Supreme Court provides clarification. Here, the court rejected a constitutional claim 8-0, and there were three separate opinions saying, different things about this. That there was agreement on among eight justices that the predicate for a constitutional violation had not been met because there hadn't been any kind of significant deviation or revision in Florida law. So I think that's the holding of the case, and I think all this Sturm und Drang about judicial takings and substantive and procedural due process and so forth really has to just be regarded as kind of dicta that doesn't really support the judgment one way or the other. And so I would just advise parties that they'd have to litigate both the takings theory, judicial takings theory, and the due process theory and see what happens.
Thanks, Tom. Kent, how would you advise clients?
Of course, I would advise my clients to argue both theories, obviously, because you don't have one controlling theory in this case. And I think what the court did say, at least six justices said, the Constitution provides a remedy for situations where a state court declares that a private property right no longer exists in some form or fashion, albeit the exact test and when that happens in a given factual case, we have yet to see because, as Tom noted, on the facts of this case, they said the Florida Supreme Court didn't do that. But there's at least six justices that say there's a constitutional remedy, which means there's a constitutional claim if a state court does this. So I would advise my clients, obviously, to assert the judicial takings doctrine claim as well as the procedural and substantive due process claim that Kennedy alluded to, and so that you'll have both of them, I guess, alive, depending on what you want the district court to or depending on what the district court wants to do with it.
Okay, I want to ask one final question and may perhaps do a little bit of prognostication in a case that may well go to the Supreme Court next term on a petition for cert. It's a case out of Hawaii where the Hawaii legislature had determined that henceforth, from a certain date forward, all natural accretions to property would belong to the state and would no longer belong to the state, which would seem to be an obvious derogation of the common law. But the legislature thought that was the best way of proceeding in dealing with newly accreted lands in Hawaii. And in this case, which is named Mauna Loa Bay Beach Ohana 28 versus State of Hawaii, it's a 2009 case. The Hawaiian Court of Appeals upheld the ability of the State of Hawaii to do that, saying that the State of Hawaii, as does any state, does have the right to come in and change the common law as the state finds is necessary for various public purposes. And the Hawaiian Supreme Court turned down review of that case just before the Stop the Beach Renourishment case came down, the Hawaiian Supreme Court denied a review on June 9th. So there could be, in this or a similar case, a pending issue of a legislature that changes the common law, pretty clearly changes traditional understandings of the common law, at least the common law that exists in the mainland states, and a court saying that that was acceptable behavior because that was in the power of the legislature to do that. So, assuming I correctly set out those facts, and the litigants in the case may dispute that a little bit, but assuming I correctly laid that out, is this a taking? Is this a legislative taking? Is it a judicial taking? Or can common law property rights be changed at the will of the legislature? Do you want to comment on that, and then Tom?
Yeah, I would say it would be Jim, just based on your description, again, I'm not familiar with the specific facts in the Mauna Loa case, but if you look at the language that Scalia used, albeit a plurality language, when he expressed the test for judicial takings, he uses the words, if a legislature or a court declares that what was once an established right of a private property no longer exists, it has taken that property. So, yes, if a legislature takes property that's established, and as long as the litigants can show that it was a clearly established property right, I would say that they have a strong basis for finding and taking, at least under Scalia's plurality test. Now, the bigger question is, can they meet the test of Justice Kennedy, who also indicates that if a court eliminates or substantially changes established property rights, which are a legitimate expectation of the owner, that such a decision would be arbitrary or irrational. So in that case, I think the facts would be probably a lot stronger than the facts that we had in the Stop the Beach Renourishment case for the court to find an actual constitutional violation there.
Tom, could you comment on the hypotheticals I set it out on this case?
Yeah, it doesn't sound – it sounds like a real case, not a hypothetical.
I'm sorry when I said hypothetical.
Yeah.
Could you comment on this case as a fact?
Yeah.
I set them out?
No, it's very interesting. It's not a judicial takings case. The state legislature decided to do this. It sounds to me like a bad idea, but they decided to do it. It's more complicated, I think, than Kent is suggesting, and I'm sure that Scalia's opinion is going to be read the way Kent suggests, but I don't think that that's probably the way ultimately things will shake out. It can't be the case that any modifications in future property rights automatically result in takings determinations. You know, legislatures are fiddling with property rights fairly frequently. They abolish dower and courtesy, and they adopt, you know, forced spousal shares. They change the rule against perpetuities into a wait-and-see doctrine rather than a what-might-have-been doctrine. All these changes, insofar as they might affect a vested right and sort of take away some possessory interest that somebody already has, I think then you'd have a very serious takings claim. But if they just simply affect future claims that have not yet materialized, such as future accretion, I think probably you'd have to demonstrate under some established takings test that the effect of that was sufficiently severe on the property owner that it would qualify as a taking under something like the Penn Central test or the Loretto test or the Lucas test. The Hawaii case strikes me as one where it's going to be hard for the property owners to win on a takings theory because, the accretion that's talked about is not something that happened last year that's being taken away. I think that would almost certainly be a taking, but something that might happen in the future, which hasn't arrived yet. And as to that, it'd be a little bit analogous to the legislature deciding that they're not going to be, you know, height controls and how high you can build or setback controls on where you can put your house relative to the property line, and those sorts of things have all been upheld against takings challenges on the grounds that they leave, you know, substantial value remaining in the original property owner's rights. So I think that there was a further step in the analysis that Justice Scalia's opinion and the other opinions didn't reach, which was even if we did show or could show that there was a elimination of a established property right, was that elimination sufficiently severe to qualify as a taking under otherwise applicable takings tests? On due process, Kennedy's opinion leaves just millions of unanswered questions. I mean, if he's talking substantive due process, is he assuming the rational basis test that we typically associate with due process, where all you have to do is show some kind of, you know, reasonable state purpose behind some modification of property rights by a court or by the legislature? If that's what he's talking about, it's not very much protection at all. What exactly is he thinking about when he mentions procedural due process? Is it sort of like an administrative law notion that if the court, the state Supreme Court, let's say, changes the law in a way that the parties didn't anticipate, that they've been deprived of notice and an opportunity to give reasons in response to that change in the law? It was very unclear exactly what he had in mind in talking about due process and all that very much remains to be hashed out.
Thank you, Tom. Kent and Tom, do you have any final thoughts on the opinion and where everybody goes forward from here?
Well, my only thought, at least with respect to the Florida law issues, as I noted earlier, I think the litigation in Florida specific to these beach restoration cases now will turn to a fact-specific issue as to whether this erosion control line is being placed in the proper location, because as we discussed earlier, most of these beaches are washed away because of hurricanes, which cause avulsion, and under the common law, that doesn't change the property boundary line, so the line should be further to sea than it is at the time of the restoration project. So I think that's where the litigation is going to go in Florida. And with respect to other federal litigation that I think the door has been opened to in terms of this opinion, who knows where it'll go.
Thank you, Kent. Tom Merrill, do you have any final thoughts?
Well, I guess I would make a slightly step back a little bit and sort of ask, where are we in terms of the property rights in the Supreme Court more generally? I think there's sort of a high water mark was reached in retrospect in 1992 in the Lucas decision when the court adopted the categorical rule that loss of all economic value is presumptively a taking. Since then, it's been pretty much downhill for property rights in the Supreme Court, at least under the takings clause. The court has chipped away at Lucas and has failed to extend the takings clause in a variety of contexts where the issues have been presented to it. This case, again, represents a defeat for property owners. I think there's a problem in that I think a significant component of the justices are very interested in property rights and eager to decide cases that might reinforce property owners' rights. But partially because of the exhaustion rules that you have to go through in order to get your case into federal court, and the fact that almost all these cases get channeled through state courts before they can even have a shot at direct Supreme Court review, the court has not been taking cases that present on their facts compelling circumstances for recognizing constitutional rights of property holders. This, I think, is another case where it turned out that on the facts, the predicate for the judicial takings theory wasn't there. Eight justices unanimously agreed with that. The net effect is sort of a deflationary one because it looks like the court's not, enforcing property rights vigorously. And so I think we've had this recurring pattern now since 92 of disappointing rulings from a property owner's perspective by the Supreme Court. And I think ultimately it's attributable to a rather poor selection of cases being presented to them and maybe poor judgment in picking which cases to decide.
Right. And the only last note I would have to Tom's comments there, and the thought just came to me, that it seemed to me that Justice Kennedy, in his concurring opinion, really invited invited a case to the court to reconsider the procedural limitations of Williamson County, in the same vein that Chief Justice Rehnquist did, I think, in a concurring opinion in the San Remo Hotel case. So, if I was a litigant that could pick cases to take to the court, I think that might be the next one property rights advocates, could prevail on. But I'm just reading tea leaves there in Kennedy's concurrence.
No, this is Tom again. I noticed that comment, too. It was quite interesting. I would point out that there were four votes in San Remo for reconsidering Williamson County. The reason there weren't five votes is that Justice Scalia declined to join that opinion. And again, there's nothing in his opinion in this case suggesting that somehow he thinks the exhaustion rules are wrong or need to be reconsidered. So there's a very interesting puzzle here as to exactly whether the court ultimately would have five votes for that. But you're right, Kennedy clearly thinks that Williamson County is bad news for property owners and is inviting a challenge of that.
Right. Well, you. you might think that Kennedy and Scalia could get together, and Kennedy could give him a vote on judicial takings, and Scalia could give him a vote on Williamson County.
Maybe so.
First trading at the Supreme Court, eh? For those who aren't intimately familiar with Williamson County, that is a Supreme Court case that has held that it's been interpreted to mean that if you bring a taking claim, you have to bring it first in state court. You cannot go into federal court until you complete your remedies in state court. But the problem is, we know from subsequent cases, that once you complete your remedies in state court, the takings claim has been decided, and that would be res judicata for anything in federal court, which basically shuts the door to litigants of taking claims against state and local governments. It just does not allow them to get into federal court, except for a petition for cert to the U.S. Supreme Court. Many property owners have been very unhappy about that. I can tell you that for behalf of Pacific Legal Foundation, we have brought three, four, five cases at petition stage to the Supreme Court on the Williamson County issue, and we've had them all turned down. So how interested is the court now to rehear Williamson County in light of what it said in San Remo and now the concurrence here in Stop the Beach? Who knows? We'll try again, but I think Tom put his finger on it. The enigma here is Justice Scalia, who does not seem to be terribly upset by this procedural rule. We will see. Gentlemen, I want to thank you very, very much for participating in this discussion. We had with us today Kent Seyfried with the Hopping Green and Sam's firm in Tallahassee, who argued the case on behalf of the property owners. We had Tom Merrill, who is the Charles Evan Hughes Professor of Law at Columbia University, who argued the case on behalf of Walton County and City of Destin. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For related materials to this podcast and other Federal Society multimedia, please visit the Federal Society's website at federalsociety.org/multimedia. Thank you very much.